Hi, good afternoon, everybody. It's Robin Gullison, the lead strategist from the Harbor Group. This is welcome to our December 2016 conference call held one day early. Thank you very much for joining us today. I've got Graham McGregor, partner of the Harbor Group, with me in the room. And we have a very special guest on the phone, Jim Allworth, calling in from Vancouver. He's RBC's chief investment strategist for RBC Wealth Management. And Jim's going to be taking us through his outlook for 2017. On our website, under the market commentary section, you'll find a couple of documents. There's one full document called the RBC Wealth Management Global Insight 2017 Outlook. And there's also a slide package. I believe it says Jim Allworth commentary on it. And there's about 40 slides there. Jim's promised to only spend 2 minutes per slide, so hopefully we'll have you off the call here in an hour and a half. Just kidding. You know, typically we try and keep these calls to about 15, 20 minutes. Jim's going to go through his presentation. I've got a couple of questions for him after, and then we'll have everybody on their way. So, Jim, are you there?
I am, Robin. Thank you.
Great, Jim. I'll take it away.
Great. Thank you for the invitation. I hope you can hear me all right. Let me know if you can't.
If you could speak up just a little bit, actually, Jim.
I think I'll try that right into the handset. How's that?
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Great. Robin's right. I'm not going to go through this slide by slide, and I'm not going to go through the global economic outlook or global insight year-ahead outlook page by page. What I'd like to do is give you perhaps a broader brush picture of what we see, and hopefully that will stimulate maybe some questions and some thought, and also give you a background with which to look at all these things. And by the way, the slides, well, you already have, are available, and if you've got questions on any of these, I would certainly welcome them. A few things have changed out there. We've been so focused on the Fed for a long time and where it was going and what was driving it there. And then we got two pretty unexpected political events happen, Brexit followed by the U.S. Election, both coming in as surprises. And both involving big potential changes for not only the two countries who had the vote, but for pretty well everybody else. So we have a new landscape to look at, and as so often happens, you get dealt cards you didn't expect. This is important to us because our framework and the way we approach things essentially could be summed up this way. If you can get the economy right, you can get financial markets right. And all this obviously plays into the potential for economic growth in the global economy and in those specific economies and in our own economy in the coming several years. So this needs to be interpreted. I would say that we have had another longstanding view out there, and I would say right off the bat it doesn't change, but that view is that as an investor, if you can see no U.S. recession on the horizon, then history suggests that you should be giving equities the benefit of the doubt and only really change that position in a significant way when that recession gets closer and becomes inevitable. Since virtually all recessions have been the result of policy, and the vast majority of them a change in credit policy, that has sort of tipped our analysis. We look at credit policy diligently and look at credit markets and decide whether monetary conditions are easy or tight, and easy monetary conditions are stimulative for the economy and for stock values, and tight money is the opposite. There are other policy options. Tax is one of the big ones. And one of the very few recessions that didn't have a credit market trigger was one back in the mid to late 30s when the U.S. government lost its nerve, having run big deficits in the Depression in an attempt to bring it out, that attempt was successful. The economy in the U.S. was recovering very smartly from the depths of the Depression. Government lost its nerve and decided to raise taxes and not run big deficits and snuffed the recovery out. So tax is certainly one to watch, but I think you'll agree that we haven't had an election result that is arguing for higher taxes, so that's unlikely to be the thing that creates the next recession in the U.S. There are plenty of other policy balls in the air, though, and we should probably touch on them. So what I would suggest we could do today is talk a bit about the U.S. And what's going on, because to us it's the economy that drives much of the world, still 25% of world GDP, and almost everybody's best customer, all the more so because the dollar has been strong. And so it has a very powerful tractor effect on the rest of the world, especially if it's growing. And so getting to some view on that is important. And what we've had here is an economy that's been stumbling along at an unsatisfactory pace, at least in the minds of the people in the U.S., which has something to do with electoral unrest. People don't feel good at 2% growth. They feel good at 3% or better growth. And they've been moving along at 2. It's been quite reasonable, and it's had a rather benign impact, which we would sum up with in the phrase, no boom, no bust. Growth running at 2 to 2.5% has not ignited shortages or capacity constraints or rapid wage gains that the Fed would have to respond to. And so the Fed has been able to stay on the sidelines. Since it will be the Fed that in all likelihood ends all this by tightening monetary conditions to a point that it squeezes growth substantially, this has been good news. And we've had an extended cycle. It's gone on for quite some time. And in our view, prior to the events of the last few months, probably could have gone on into 2018 and perhaps beyond before the Fed, in its avowedly patient and deliberate way, finally got rates moved up to a point where they started to bite a bit. So one of the questions we have is, has that sort of an assumption changed in here? Has a new broom in the administration with a platform that's decidedly expansionist going to change that whole picture? And in our view, it will. On the one hand, it's likely to give some short-term stimulus to the economy next year and the year thereafter. On the other hand, it is likely to eat up spare capacity faster than it otherwise would and produce enough inflation that the Fed will have to respond, even though they have said they are willing to let the economy run hot for a while. So one big impact here is that while we were resting on our oars and reasonably confident that easy money would be with us for an extended period of time, and I think the favored mantra out there in the fixed income world is lower for longer, this change in direction, this move towards large infrastructure spending, very large deficits, brought about not only by the spending but by very large tax cuts, says to us that the Fed won't be able to stay on the sidelines as long as we might have thought. So for us, from a strategic standpoint, says diligence is and paying attention is very important here. That there isn't just momentum that's going to carry on. We have to watch and see whether those more negative impacts arrive sooner than they might have. The impact so far, from what we can tell, looks to us as though there are some positives and some negatives, and maybe I'll just briefly tell you the view of our economists on this. If we got infrastructure spending, and pretty well nobody believes we're going to get it all, so our forecast is that we would get half of what has been proposed. And just as, so that you know, we're not sober Canadians who are unduly pessimistic, you should know that Goldman Sachs thinks they'll only get a third of the infrastructure that's proposed through. And that we get most of the taxes, but not all. Again, so some. And putting those two together would give us a decent bump in economic growth in both years. But, of course, there are other effects that are coming along with all this. The first one is just the fact that this takes time to get done. So most people believe that the earliest you could be with a bill in Congress and on the budget is probably April, May. and implementation then becomes something that happens in the second half. And so whatever benefits you're going to get in 2016 really don't start to arrive until the second half. And yet you're already have incurred some costs. We have a dollar that's up sharply, and we have long-term interest rates that are up fairly sharply. And those are both going to exact a cost on economic growth in the months prior to the point where you get any gain at all. So we're already enduring some costs from this. We're going to endure more in the first half, and we're really not going to get the payoff until the second. The second thing, of course, that's hard to measure is what this does to uncertainty or certainty, however way you want to look at it. But it seems to us that businesses and indeed even individuals who are making large purchases, but businesses who are contemplating CapEx of any kind or more commitment of capital are loath to do that in a period where the rules may be changing, where there may be all kinds of issues that they may be faced, like tariffs and a tax regime that hasn't been put in place yet and hasn't even been proposed yet. So this, to us, takes a little bit of the shine off another number that came out subsequent to this that was very positive, and that was that CEO confidence went up fairly substantially. And usually that's been a precursor to better corporate earnings a year down the road, and we think it may well be, but it still leaves you this valley to get over when you may be more optimistic, but are you actually willing to do anything about it in a world of uncertain rules? And while I haven't seen the latest surveys yet, there's another group to hear from, and that's the National Federation of Independent Business, who is an organization that represents small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. and has tens of thousands of members and surveys them all pretty regularly. And a very common complaint from that whole constituency, and a very vocal one and an almost unanimous one, is the dampening and killing impact of overregulation and just too many forms to fill out to hire somebody or to fire somebody or to do almost anything, and they find it a huge burden, and that may be, and in fact was one of the platforms of this administration when they were elected, so we may actually see some benefit there, and we may see rising optimism and probably hiring from that sector too. So there are good things, but there are certainly some baggage that goes with this that makes it not exactly unanimous. Well, generally speaking, better growth for the U.S., not as good as it seems just on the surface when you start adding up the costs, but still better. But once you get into 2019 and beyond, the good stuff falls away in terms of its impact on growth. And the bad stuff, which is the effect of protectionism to the extent we see it, and we think we will, and other trade issues, and the higher costs associated with both a stronger dollar in a way on reporting earnings and on higher interest rates, overwhelm the good stuff, and we start to see a net drag, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the global economy. So this, in some sense, for us as investors, is making hay while the sun shines. While people remain optimistic and while the high likelihood is you'll get at least some additional growth out of this, we think markets can hold together. When that starts to give way to a more ambitious Fed and waning benefits from the fiscal stimulus, then presumably that presents the other side of the coin for us. But at this point, it still looks to us like that's 2018, probably at the earliest. Another point that we made in our opening letter in the Global Insight is that whatever benefits the U.S. manages to achieve from itself through this new platform may actually be a subtraction from other people. And there are trade issues out there. There is a whole – we haven't seen a real proposal, a budget proposal, but at the moment there is a lot of talk being floated within the Republican Party from the putative administration that is talking about taxing imports at the corporate tax rate as they come in, and giving exporters a similar tax rate on the way out. And you can call it tax, but it's tariff, and tariffs are not great, and tariffs usually provoke a response from other people, the people affected on the other side. Some of those people on the other side are actually American corporations, but there's certainly plenty of countries out there who would be aggrieved. And of course, when this was proposed and following the election, China had a response to it right away and said if there's going to be a tariff on Chinese goods, then the first thing China would do would be change its Boeing order to an Airbus order and stop importing U.S. soybeans and stop importing U.S. corn, and then go back and think about it and see what else they could do. So that, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a trade war to me. And there is that possibility that people will not lie down and accept a more restrictive regime from the U.S. without a response. And tit for tat being what it is, this can get worse. And in fact, I think that is the issue that's out there that is provoking people and that is of concern. Almost everything else that goes on in the economy has self-correcting aspects to it. Protectionism is one of those things that doesn't. And we've lived through an era, certainly since World War II, of more and more and more liberalized trade. And that wasn't achieved easily. It was achieved usually at some political cost to the people who proposed liberalizing trade rules, because you were almost always taking some short-term pain for a long-term gain. A great number of people and countries signed on to that idea over a lot of time. We've had threats to it occasionally that have usually been fought off, but if this one isn't, then one of the issues in protectionism is there's no self-correcting mechanism that starts reopening the trade doors after they've slammed shut. And so I think it's of concern. And I don't find it particularly concerning in the short run, but it's something that would, I think, weigh into our assessment of what a subsequent downturn in the economy might be two or three years out if it was a large factor or any factor really in the economic trajectory at that time. So I think one to pay attention to and watch, and I think we are. You can argue that this isn't a bilateral world or a mercantilist world, and that, for example, to use Boeing as an example, you know, I forget whether it's something like 60% of all the what goes into a Boeing airline these days is made outside the U.S. And then heads into the U.S. for assembly. And, of course, an awful lot of the parts that are made outside the U.S. are made by countries where there was a quid pro quo that they would turn around and order Boeing jetliners in return for having some of the airliner made in their own country. And those sorts of things become problematic, obviously, in this kind of a world, and are going to have a bigger blow on some companies than others. But it is an issue. Can I maybe move to Europe and to Asia quickly and get back to Canada? Europe has two huge challenges, and perhaps this whole question we've just talked about is adding a third. The first one is that it seems unable to break away from these existential issues that keep facing it. Can it survive as an organization as currently constituted? Does it have to go through some big reform? When might that happen? And every time we get to another big watershed moment, one hopes that the skies will clear, but clearly they don't. So we have a referendum in Italy in another week, and we have general elections in Germany and France next year. Eurosceptic parties are, for the most part, on the rise ever since Brexit and emboldened by Brexit. People routinely say that Marie Le Pen in France cannot possibly win enough seats to get power, but she can make a good showing. And, you know, in the UK, the UKIP party only managed to elect one member of parliament, but it led the Brexit vote fight. And so any increased exposure and influence by any of these parties can put all these questions back in a jump ball position. The same is true in Germany. There is a rising Eurosceptic party. It has a very charismatic leader. It's got a very small part of the vote, but again, could be influential in other ways. There is a chart in the package that shows the change in people's sentiment about the Eurozone in a whole variety of countries, and what you see is that very few countries remain positively disposed, at least their electorates remain positively disposed towards the EU. Most people are becoming more frustrated by it. I don't think the EU is going away, but I think the uncertainty around it continues to be an issue. And again, if you're a U.S. corporation or a Japanese corporation and you're thinking about establishing an operation in Europe, or indeed if you're a European company thinking about building new facilities in Europe, very difficult to do if you are uncertain about what the rules are going to be and the currency you're going to be dealing with is an issue as well. And uncertainty leaves businesses sitting on their hands, and foreign direct investment has been affected by this already, even if consumers and general business attitudes haven't. We think there's more of the same coming. So we are inclined to think that Europe isn't going to break out of this. It's on a bit of an upswing in terms of its activity indexes lately, but we think that's not onward and upward, but rather upward and stalling out at unsatisfactory long-term growth rates. The second issue facing Europe is much bigger and more profound, and that is that the working age population in Europe, especially in the developed countries, has started to crest and to roll down. And it's very hard to engineer economic growth when your working age population is in decline. Japan, of course, is the poster child for this. It's had a very hard time putting together two successive years of decent growth ever since the late 1980s. And that's been a period in which it's been faced with the same problem. It's now going to become Europe's problem. It's eventually going to become everybody's problem. But Europe is really next on the list and is going to have a very hard time manufacturing growth that people will view as acceptable in that kind of a world. Coincidentally, the best demographic profile of any country in the industrialized world, for sure, is the U.S., who are not going to face this decline in working age population until well into the latter part of the 2020s, and are also about to start to see for the first time in almost 20 years a resurgence and reacceleration of growth in the over 20 group, who tend to be peak spenders in the economy and drive growth. And, of course, this is all thanks to the one thing that clearly American voters don't like, which is illegal immigration. The U.S. managed to fill in the baby valley that follows the baby boom with that immigration, and that's largely now all cut off. The border crossings are already down about more than 80% in the last number of years. And while that may make them feel better in one sense, it is in another sense kind of cutting off their nose to spite their face. But this problem of declining working age population is a profound one and a difficult one for Europe. Can I quickly go to China and get to Canada? China is going to have the same problem, rapidly aging working age population, but of course it still has the China ace up its sleeve, and that is that 30 to 35% of all the people in China who are working are underemployed. And you see this very distinctly when you look at agriculture. Agriculture is about 10% of GDP in China, but it employs about 30% of the workforce, highly inefficient. If China was a developed country instead of a developing country, agriculture would probably be only 4% of GDP and employ 3% or less of the population. The Chinese strategy of modernization and urbanization, which they pursued ever since reforms in the early 80s, could be restated to be one of bringing the peasant off the land and into the urban workforce, setting him or her at a workbench and making them instantly more productive than they were in a very inefficient and unproductive agricultural sector. This has been highly successful. However, all developing countries who embark on this face the same problem at the beginning, for sure, and for some time after, and that is that when they sit that peasant down at the workbench to make something, they have to have someone who can buy what he makes. And China has not had the domestic demand to absorb the flow of people into that workforce sufficiently to keep things going and keep aspirations where they need to be. And so they have done, again, what every developing country does. They find other people's demand and they export. China, again, has done that fairly intently. But it's a new era out there, and China has some problems. One is that they're not nearly as competitive as they used to be. They arbitrarily raised wages by the central government forced manufacturers to raise wages by a very large amount, 30 to 50% about 3 years ago, because of great dissatisfaction in the workforce with working conditions and pay. That has substantially reduced whatever cost benefit they would have had or cost advantage they would have had over the U.S. for goods that are manufactured for sale in the U.S. China has been losing employment to low-wage countries. They have to get their mojo back, and to do that, to become more competitive, they have a couple of stark choices. I'm sure there's a whole lot of middle ground things they can do, too, but one, you can go back to the people whose wages you've just engineered higher by 30 to 50% and explain that you've overshot and that you need to bring them back by 10 to 20%, and I think that just is not on in the name of sort of voter stability. The second thing you can do is what almost everyone else does, which is fiddle with something that people don't see directly, and that's the currency. And China has, in fact, embarked on a period now of currency depreciation. The renminbi is down about 8% over the last year. I don't foresee continued depreciation at that kind of rate, but I do think that, and we think that the Chinese currency will depreciate by 1 to 2% or maybe 1 to 3% a year for at least a few years running here. That changes a few things. One of them, it inspires a desire for capital to get out of the country, which can be a problem and can give you currency volatility. Two, it changes that race that everybody's watching as when China becomes the largest economy in the world, and it's clearly a lot further out than people had thought. So China is growing at about 6.5% in real terms by its own account here, but it in the last year it gave up 8% in currency vis-a-vis the U.S., so it actually shrank, and that was in a year when the U.S. grew by 2.5%. So what looked like a sprint to the finish line when China was growing at 11 and its currency was strong and the U.S. was growing at 1 and its currency was weak has kind of gone the other way here, and we're in, I think, a marathon that might go on for some time. China and the U.S. are the bookends to our economy here in Canada. And we sell most of what we ship out of this country to the U.S., but a high proportion of it, the resource component is priced in China. So having a U.S. economy that's strong or at least moving along at a reasonable pace with consumers who are confident and a currency that's stronger and an appetite for some of the things we produce is good news. And if China can kind of hold in at this rate of growth for a while, which is a big, and there's a big question mark around that, then it we gradually get some discipline back into some commodity markets and supplies more right-sized against potential demand, and that's, again, good for pricing of our commodity exports. And for the most part, that has been the picture of the last year. and we think could go on being that picture. But we now have this new wild card, which is what part of all these trade restrictions that are being mooted by the new administration are going to affect us. And certainly some sort of blanket tariff wall of import, of putting a tariff on all imported goods is going to affect us. There's no doubt about that. Something that makes room for various agreements, so our own free trade agreement with the U.S., which was with us ahead of NAFTA and would be what we would default back to at least initially. Whether that leaves room for us, it's, again, hard to say, and uncertainty rules here, and is going to go on ruling from what we can tell for a while. We do think that the Canadian economy is, if you left that uncertainty out of the question, was coming into better times. We saw a good third quarter report recovering from Fort McMurray, which in Fort McMurray kind of covered up the fact that most other parts of the economy were doing well in the quarter that it drove a hole in GDP. Manufacturing is not doing badly at all when you remove the part of manufacturing sales that is petroleum-related, which is mostly gasoline. When you take out all those petroleum-related components, you find that manufacturing sales in Canada, excluding them, have grown at a very nice pace ever since the recession ended, and that is starting to show up in exports as well, obviously aided and abetted by a weaker dollar. We think our dollar is going to stay on the back foot because Governor Politz has shown no appetite for accompanying Chairman Yellen on a move towards higher interest rates. He has not ruled out, and most other central banks have not ruled out, even further ease if it's required. The environment we just described here would suggest to us that his uncertainty isn't going to go away any sooner than ours is. So we think that there's still the possibility of a weaker dollar, and here we have decent evidence today, I would say, with oil up sharply and our dollar really not responding commensurately. We're reasonably hopeful for the Canadian economy. We think all the things we've seen so far, if they go through in the way we think, that is partly but not wholly, will take a toll on our growth of about 0.25% a year out over the next several years, but that won't be enough to by itself give us grief. And let me perhaps finish this on the oil note. As the Saudi Arabian said the other day while we were leading up to this deal that was announced today, said that they really didn't have to do anything because they just left things alone and where they were, that the oil market was coming more and more into balance, that demand was growing, and that in a year or so that we would be back in a much tighter market. And I think that's a pretty good description. We think that by the end of 2017 and into 2018, we will see a market that's maybe even in deficit, and there will be some stronger prices. We do, however, if you look at our estimated prices, they really are only kind of in the 50s next year and in the low 60s the year after that. And to really have an impact on the Canadian economy, let me just say it's great news for conventional producers. It's great news for all producers who are producing to have a stronger price environment on the assumption that Canadian producers can actually get that benefit, and sometimes they can't because of wide differentials, but let's assume they can. The real issue here is, can we get energy prices back to a level that will reignite the development potential for high-cost oil? I don't think there's anyone in our commodity brains trust or economics group who believe that we're going to have the kind of sustained pricing that will quickly reignite development of high-cost oil in Canada, and hence we don't see strong additions to GDP from that, and we think just Alberta remains challenge, not to the degree they have been. We think there's some improvement coming. It's just the idea that an oil deal from OPEC and stronger oil prices really has a limited impact, and we think that's what we're already seeing in the dollar, that our dollar would be a lot stronger if we were at price levels or heading towards price levels that we're going to get development back on track. Robin, I thought what I would do is stop there, and maybe if there's a question or two, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for that very comprehensive, tour around the world, very balanced outlook on the new U.S. administration and what they're going to be bringing. And it's one of the questions we've had is that, oftentimes in the past we've spoken to you, you talk about Canada and the U.S. being joined at the hip as far as economic growth goes. If the U.S. is actually able to get up to that 3% growth rate, will it be able to drag Canada along with it, or do you think they'll get that kind of growth at the expense of trade with countries like Canada? And on the trade front, it seems like, from my kind of untrained eye, that Trump's strategy so far has been to kind of go out guns blazing on the campaign, and then any really major controversial strategy he's put forward, he seems to have really backed off on. Do you think he'll do that to the same degree on the trade side? Just kind of as, this has all been an opening gamut?
Oh, it's a great question, and fortunately I have great psychoanalytic training, so I'll try to tell you what I think. I think we're still going to be joined at the hip, but our hip got half a percent lower than it's been in the past. So I think the direction we're going to go in will be the same as the Americans. But I think there is going to be a cost to this. And again, I can't read their mind. And I agree with your assessment that to some degree there's, 1 minute it was a wall made of bricks and guys were buying cement manufacturers, and the next minute it's a virtual wall. And I think that can be true with all the stuff that, and then of course you've got to get Congress to go for it, and so there's lots of ways to water that down, and we think they do get watered down, and we might get lucky and somehow or other escape all this. And lots of people have made the case to me that he seems to have be laser focused on Mexico and not on us, but we are the big trading partner. And they have enough grievances with us, and they're about to re-embark on the softwood lumber exercise. So it seems kind of silly to wish and hope that he won't turn his view on us eventually, and I think he will. And we'll kind of feel the combative blast. But I think we can stand in there unless this turns into something much bigger and more nasty with other people, and then I think there can be a lot of collateral damage, and we might suffer from some of that.
Okay.
So I don't think he's going to get 3-4% growth. That's my first estimate, and our sentiment is that what he's going to get is kind of high twos. And then the second part is I think that we will follow him in direction, but probably not fully realize the growth rate that he manages to get.
Okay, great. So last question would be, after a few years of underperformance, the Canadian market has outperformed the U.S. this year. Do you think the TSX can keep up next year? And in the same vein, what sectors do you think are the best place to position for the next year?
Well, I think the materials continue to do well because inventories in some of them have been right-sized more than people realized, and many people kind of took the pledge and said they just weren't going to go there, and then small bits of demand or even rumored demand turns people willing to hold on to inventory longer than they would have otherwise, and we get some pretty good price moves in quite a number of commodities. We also had, I think, less related to China or anything like that, but we did have a huge despair in the energy market in January and February with all kinds of people coming out of the woodwork saying that $10 a barrel was just around the corner, and then we have oil up at one point 100% from its lows. And we think there's more momentum, not of that fireworks variety, but more momentum in most commodities that will give us a reasonable commodity environment. So that certainly serves us well with that being a big part of our index weight. And of course, all these things are useful for the financial sector, which is the other big part. And it never hurts to remind ourselves that the two big sectors we've got, financials and energy and materials, are much, much more highly represented in the market than they are in our economy. But so be it. That's a historical accident, if you like, an artifact, and they are. And so we have to look at both, and the financials look better to us because higher long-term interest rates, which are happening, give a steeper yield curve and are better for bank earnings and for LifeCo earnings. And because some relief from the terrible price decline in energy in particular, but other commodities too, have changed the credit outlook for banks and the credit cycle outlook, and the idea of bad loans stemming from those sectors has diminished considerably. And so the bank earnings outlook, I think, is quite good. And as one of my former colleagues pointed out to me yesterday, banks have undertaken big cost-cutting efforts, and cost-cutting usually takes a year to pay off, but it does. And so that payoff is still lies ahead of us for many of those two important sectors. When you get in the middle of the market, between those two sectors, you have a kind of problem of again, distortion. If you were any portfolio manager who was trying to get away from the commodity sector because of potential price weakness, and trying to get away from the bank sector because you imagined that those problems in materials and energy were going to affect the bank earnings, then you're pushed more and more towards the middle part of the market, where we the number of investable names is much smaller. And so an awful lot of companies in Canada in that middle part of the market, industrials and communications and telcos and consumer stocks of all kinds, tended to benefit from this money flowing out of worrying sectors and into their sectors. And so whatever value gaps that used to exist between those companies in Canada and their counterparts in the U.S. has disappeared. So we like the Canadian market because the two big sectors look good to us, but the middle part of the market remains usually a problem on valuation. And hence, that's why we continue to recommend that Canadian investors have a substantial position in U.S. stocks.
Great. Jim, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for joining us, and to everybody on the call, thank you very much for dialing in. We're going to be in touch with you over the next few weeks about our next call in January. We have another special guest, so more details to come. Thank you very much, and have a good day.